Hey everybody, welcome to 2ZQ Hot Takes, where we discuss issues both big and small. I am your host, the very handsome Tim Kirk, and this time I'll be talking about doing whatever you can to prevent the onset of dementia. Now, I had recently had dinner with two of my oldest friends. We've all known each other for well over 50 years, and a conversation eventually came to dementia and what we could do to prevent the onset of dementia, considering my father passed away at age 95 and he was suffering from dementia. And we had learned of other people who had dementia. One of our dearest friends died young of a brain disease, and he had the aphasia condition that is exactly the same as what Bruce Willis is currently suffering from. And he died at a very young age. He was 35. He wasn't even 36 years old. And it was a different disease than what is considered dementia now. It is an actual brain disease that is a known clinical condition. And having been someone who has visited my parents when they were both still with us in Florida, a number of times over the course of years that they lived there, inevitably, their friends' circle had diminished by one of the married couples passing away. And while they were still together, the number of them had a spouse who suffered from the onset of and advancing symptoms of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So it's common, and you get to see this in aging parents and their friends. So, you know, it is something that you become aware of and you keep in the back of your mind, and you don't give it altogether that much thought until it actually happens to some member of your family, like it happened to my father. And recently, I had been seeing a documentary miniseries on Netflix, which I had discussed with my friends over dinner, called You Are What You Eat. Now, granted, it is slanted, but it's supposed to be, you know, supposedly, you know, doing so for the benefit of the viewers. And the idea is that the show was about 21 sets of identical twins. And the program, this miniseries, focused on four sets of identical twins. And they were both studied, young, older, male, female, all different races and weight and fitness levels. And the idea was to have one of the twins of each of these four pairs living with a vegan plant-based diet, and the other living with an omnivore diet. Everything in their life was measured through different devices and circumstances. So the output is, or the upshot is, that we should really try to move to a plant-based diet. There's a lot of evidence that's emerging recently about your biogene and how gut health affects the onset of dementia. And my two friends and myself were discussing this as I was discussing my dad, who passed away at 95. He had suffered from dementia. So with that, I've started to look at some information about dementia. And just to start off, I looked at something from the National Institute of Health, the National Library of Medicine, and I'm just taking just the very skimming the top of the surface of this. But it says, and it came from Arnold Schwarzenegger's daily email newsletter, and there was a hyperlink to this. And the headline is, Does Bilingualism Protect Against Dementia? A Meta-Analysis. And the abstract, and I'm only going to go through just a sentence or two of this, but the abstract says, evidence suggests that bilingualism may contribute to neuroplasticity and cognitive reserve allowing individuals to resist cognitive decline associated with Alzheimer's disease progression, although the idea remains controversial. Here, they argue that the reason for the discrepancy stems from conflating incident rates of dementia and the age at which the symptoms first appear, as well as statistical and methodological issues in the study designs. To clarify the issues, they conducted a comprehensive meta-analysis on the available literature regarding bilingualism and Alzheimer's disease, including both retrospective and prospective studies, as well as age of onset and incidence rates. Results revealed a moderate effect size for the protective effect of bilingualism on age of onset of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, and weaker evidence that bilingualism prevents the occurrence of disease incidence itself. Moreover, their results cannot be explained by at least three biases. They concluded with a discussion on how bilingualism contributes to cognitive reserve and protects against Alzheimer's disease, and recommends that future studies report both age of onset as well as incidence rates when possible. Now, that was from the National Institutes of Health, or the National Institute of Health. Now, there is some information that is not exactly alarming, but it is quite interesting to learn how people's minds work and how your brain works when it comes to memories. And people are confusing memories and lapses of memories with onset of dementia, or they're conveniently doing so because they're ageist, or people just don't know. And from Science Daily, there's an article that says, the human brain works backwards to retrieve memories. When we remember a past event, the human brain reconstructs that experience in reverse order, according to a new study at the University of Birmingham. Understanding more precisely how the brain retrieves information could help us better assess the reliability of eyewitness accounts, for example, of crime scenes, where people often are able to recall the overall gist of an event, but recall specific visual details less reliably. The study, published in Nature Communications, was carried out by researchers in the Center for Human Brain Health, who reconstructed the memory retrieval process using brain decoding techniques. These techniques make it possible to track when in time a unique memory is being reactivated in the brain. They found that when retrieving information about a visual object, the brain focuses first on the core meaning, recovering the gist, and only afterwards recalls more specific details. This is in sharp contrast to how the brain processes images when it first encounters them. When we initially see a complex object, it's the visual details, patterns, and colors that we perceive first. Abstract, meaningful information that tells us the nature of the object we're looking at, whether it's a dog, a guitar, or a cup, for example, comes later. We know that our memories are not exact replicas of the things we originally experienced, says Juan Linde Domingo, lead author of the study. Memory is a reconstructive process biased by personal knowledge and worldviews. Sometimes we even remember events that never actually happened, as in the Mandela effect. But exactly how memories are reconstructed in the brain, step by step, is currently not well understood. During the study, participants saw images of specific objects and then learned to associate each image with a unique reminder word, for example, the word spin or pull. The participants were later presented with the reminder word and asked to reconstruct the associated image in as much detail as possible. Brain activity was recorded throughout the task via 128 electrodes attached to the scalp, allowing the researchers to observe changes in brain patterns with millisecond precision. Finally, the researchers trained a computer algorithm to decode what kind of image the participant was retrieving at different points in the task. That alone is amazing. We were able to show that the participants were retrieving higher-level abstract information, such as whether they were thinking of an animal or an inanimate object, shortly after they heard the reminder word, explains Maria Wimber, senior author of the study. It was only later that they retrieved the specific details, for example, whether they had been looking at a color object or a black and white outline. Wow. If our memories prioritize conceptual information, this also has consequences for how our memories change when we repeatedly retrieve them, adds Linde Domingo. It suggests they will become more abstract and gist-like with each retrieval. Although our memories seem to appear in our internal eye as vivid images, they are not simple snapshots from the past, but reconstructed and biased representations. Follow-up studies will need to test whether this reversed reconstruction cascade is hardwired in the brain. If it is, the sequence of reconstruction should remain stable under different conditions, even when a person, for example, consciously focuses their attention on specific details during learning. The team is currently also looking in more detail at how and where the brain reconstructs more complex memories. Once the pathway of memory retrieval is established in the healthy brain, researchers can also start looking into how it is altered in healthy aging, or how this pathway might contribute to the overgeneralization of memories in conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder, which I find absolutely fascinating. Now, here is something else, which I think is a little bit more relevant to most people as you hit a certain point in your life. I think if you're over 50, you start having what we call senior moments. It's just you're absent-minded, and other people who are younger than you see these as symptoms of some sort of mental decay, because everybody is ageist biased whether they know it or not. We all are. So the Guardian UK has an article called "That's Just Normal Forgetting: The Difference Between Memory Loss and Dementia and How to Protect Your Brain." The odd memory lapse is no big deal, so when should we start to worry? Experts explain and share the best ways to stay sharp. Isn't it Sod's Law? Just at the point in our lives when we start seriously considering our long-term health and mortality, perhaps after witnessing older loved ones getting an illness such as dementia, as I just said, our responsibilities are piled so high that we can feel as if we are losing our mental capacities already. The names of our favorite animals and humans become interchangeable word soup. Our keys become increasingly elusive. Alerts must be set on all calendar entries. But how can we tell whether this frustrating flakiness is a reflection of age-related cognitive decline, the early signs of our own impending dementia, or merely an overly taxing phase from which we will recover? Could it even be just normal forgetfulness? We're not robots, after all. It may be reassuring to hear from neurologist Richard Restack, 82, whose new book is How to Prevent Dementia, An Expert's Guide to Long-Term Brain Health. He says that there might be a more everyday reason for memory lapse. All through life, stress causes a decrease in normal brain function. You have difficulty with memory. You can't come up with names. Of course, it's impossible to completely avoid stressful things, but one you can choose to swerve, he says, is worrying that you're getting Alzheimer's because of mild forgetfulness. There are examples of people coming out of shopping malls and being unable to remember where they parked the car. Well, that's just normal forgetting. A more worrying version of the story would be, Restack says, if you came out of the mall and you can't remember, did I drive here? Did I take a bus? Or did somebody drop me off? Restack is clearly still mentally sharp. As well as writing books, he is a clinical professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., but he calmly accepts a mild decline in his abilities that come with age. He recalls a book tour dinner many years ago in which he was introduced to a dozen new people. I had no trouble at all remembering the names, he says. I'm not sure I could do that today. Problems recalling names are easily fixable in any case, Restack tells me. Memory is based on images, not words. So I could take your name, Amy Fleming, and see a picture of you in flames, flaming. And so when I next see you, your name will come to me. Memory is also often more about paying attention than cognitive deficits. Returning to Restak's mall analogy, he says if you've got something more interesting than car park coordinates in your mind when you arrive, you won't pay attention to the seemingly insignificant car park zone, and therefore you won't lay down a memory of it. It is much harder to pay attention to things that don't excite us. Signs of a dementia-depleted memory are far more marked, says Linda Clare, professor of clinical psychology of aging and dementia at the University of Exeter. It's a real gap somewhere that there shouldn't be, she says. My own experience of this was telling my mom that I was going to make a big move from Cambridge to North Wales and that I'd found a house. And the next morning, she had no recollection of any of it. Then I knew for sure that this wasn't just normal forgetting. Claire also recalls another example of a man who got into the car and couldn't remember what the controls were for. It's those crunch moments that send you off to the doctor. But she concedes that it is hard to draw precise markers, as circumstances other than dementia can cause dramatic momentary lapses, such as urinary tract infections, hormone imbalances, mini strokes, depression, and anxiety. If you experience a dramatic memory lapse or cognitive changes that aren't normal for you, the usual investigative pathway would be a visit to a memory clinic via a GP referral. I've never even heard of a memory clinic. We're trying to encourage people, if they do notice a change in functioning, to go to the doctor, says Claire. This is partly because other health problems causing the cognitive symptoms, such as cardiovascular disease affecting blood flow to the brain, could be picked up, but also because drugs can help slow the progression of dementia if taken early. But let's roll back a little. If you're panicking because you're getting older and can't name the actor in the film you've just seen, it's worth diverting this mental energy into positive action. For example, you might want to start by learning new ways to manage stress. Try to decrease stress and cognitive function will improve, Restak says. Well, I think that's great anyway. Claire suggests breaking the vicious cycle of worrying about your health by focusing on taking care of yourself. It's not always easy, she says. Responsibilities don't go away. But is there a way to get a little bit more sleep or have someone give you a break for an hour or two to do something you want to do? Small things that keep you going are worth doing. On the other hand, having a mentally demanding job can be beneficial because it keeps the brain agile and strong and make a dementia diagnosis less likely. Whatever a person can do to stimulate their mental functioning is a good thing, says Claire. We think complex mental activities are protective. Not that having a mentally taxing job is a prerequisite for brain health. Restak's key phrase for tackling dementia is cognitive reserve, which is something you can build up like a muscle, he says. He says the brain remains highly malleable throughout the lifespan, and cognitive reserve can be built up from childhood and at any time during the next 70 years. Having a well-exercised brain will not necessarily prevent dementia, but it can keep you functional for longer if you do get the disease. Restak's top tip is to find something that viscerally interests you and indulge it like a magnificent obsession. You continue to build on it with books, you go to movies about it. That's the way the mind stays sharp. Keeping your brain doing new stuff, he says, is a way of forming new networks within the brain. This applies to learning new languages, to musical skills, and is also why you should keep up with new technology instead of letting others do it for you. Reading novels is another cognitive reserve-building power move. They demand a lot more in terms of cognitive functioning than a nonfiction book, which you can open up to whatever chapter is of interest to you, he says. You can't do that with a novel. You have to hold in your mind the story so far, who everyone is, follow the text and subtext, and use your imagination. Novels and puzzles require working memory. Working memory is associated with IQ, he says. If you've got a strong working memory, there is not a chance in the world you have dementia. Some of the exercises he suggests would strain anybody, he says. The medical definition of dementia is a loss of memory, language, problem solving, and other cognitive abilities that is severe enough to impact daily life, So if you've enough working memory to learn and name, say, all the prime ministers since the Second World War, it can be stated categorically that you do not have dementia, Ristak says. If you don't follow politics, listing the members of your football team according to position or alphabetically would do just as well. Along with reducing stress and keeping mentally agile, sleep, particularly naps, is your memory's friend. Laboratory studies confirm that naps solidify already learned information, writes Ristak. When we first learn something, that knowledge goes into the hippocampus, the brain region responsible for the initial formation of a memory. When we nap, hippocampal activity matches the pattern of activity that occurred when we learned the new information. This is called neural replay. Sleep problems often increase with age, though. Ristak says a daytime nap can prove helpful in regulating your nighttime sleep. None of this advice comes with guarantees. You can't take a specific person and predict whether or not they're going to get Alzheimer's on the basis of their lifestyle, says Ristak. A high percentage of it is genetic, but these steps will lower the odds. Avoid drinking to excess is another one, he says. Everybody recognizes that alcohol is harmful, but you have to live. If one drink a day causes you to feel better about life, I would say fine. Make up for it with the other ways of preventing dementia, doing plenty of exercise and sticking to a healthy diet, say. The evidence continues to mount, too, for looking after your cardiovascular health and hearing and for socializing as much as possible. Cheeringly, just as it's never too late to build your cognitive reserve, it's never too late to boost your systemic health. Making changes to benefit your health at any stage has an impact, says Claire. Even if you start exercising when you retire, it will still have a benefit. Do whatever you can at that time. We are never a lost cause. And there are 5 exercises in the article to help you build cognitive reserve. And this is obviously British because it says, name all of the UK's prime minister from Winston Churchill to the present day. Then do them backwards. Then put them in alphabetical order. And then separate by political party. If you don't follow politics, list all of the players in your favorite football team or famous teams in history, such as the England 1966 or France 1998 World Cup winners, according to position played or alphabetically. Go around the supermarket without referring to your shopping list until the end. Tackle puzzles such as Wordle and Sudoku. Ristak says it is useful to do anything that can enable you or compel you to move pieces of information around in your mind. And learn a new word every day. Well, there you go. That's pretty snazzy advice, I would say. But the thing that gets me is, there's another article, which I got to find. From Frontiers, predicting accuracy in eyewitness testimonies with memory retrieval effort and confidence. Now, this isn't particularly about dementia, but there's also a running parallel experience that many people seem to have a misperception about, is their own ability to recall with accuracy experiences, especially eyewitness accounts. There's something called eidetic memory, which is a photographic memory or total recall. And that's what I was talking about. Most people do not have eidetic memory or photographic memory or total recall. They just do not. They believe they do. Most people think they can sing and they can't sing either. Most people who listen to humor think they're funny, but they're not. Most people who drive cars think that they can be a race car driver, and you're not. And we go on with this. We kid ourselves into thinking about things because we like them. And it's something just because we have a particular affection or affinity for something that doesn't mean that we're good at it. And this is part of our memory. And this is something we kid ourselves about all the time. People like to think that they have a better memory than they do, but they don't. Okay, so as I said, this is a running concurrent issue with many people, and I think a lot of us love to believe that we have this great memory, and then when we have the experience of being questioned, it turns out that we don't exactly have the memory that we thought we did. Now, if you're in the workplace and you're over 50, as I said before, when you're getting older, you notice that you start being condescended to by people who are younger than you. You're excluded from all social events. You're excluded from certain types of meetings and just ad hoc assemblies because people assume that you're not interested or that you're out of it. And that anytime you have a lapse of memory, which the young people do all the time, they look at and they nod to each other. And it seems to be an indication that you're losing your grasp. And it's not particularly true for most people, although, you know, it can happen. But, you know, how many people have you ever actually worked with who were suffering from dementia, who were still in the workforce? Not a lot. I mean, really. So the article from Frontier says, predicting accuracy in eyewitness testimonies with memory retrieval effort and confidence. Evaluating eyewitness testimonies has proven a difficult task. Recent research, however, suggests that incorrect memories are more effortful to retrieve than correct memories, and confidence in a memory is based on retrieval effort. We aim to replicate and extend these findings, adding retrieval latency as a predictor of memory accuracy. Participants watched a film sequence with a staged crime and were interviewed about its content. We then analyzed retrieval effort cues in witness response. Results showed that incorrect memories included more effort cues than correct memories, while correct responses were produced faster than incorrect responses. Delays in responses proved a better predictor of accuracy than response latency. Furthermore, participants were more confident in correct than incorrect responses, and the effort cues partially mediated this confidence-accuracy relation. In sum, the results support previous findings of a relationship between memory accuracy and objectively verifiable cues to retrieval effort. And this points to the previous article. So, the introduction is that eyewitness memories are often critical sources of information for investigating what happened during a criminal offense. Although playing a central role in criminal investigations and decision-making, eyewitness evidence has often been found to be unreliable and constitutes a major contributing factor behind wrongful convictions. Erroneous eyewitness reports are sometimes due to a witness's deliberate lies about the target event. And perhaps less obvious, and another major source of eyewitness error is when a witness gives an honest report but remembers things incorrectly. While differentiating between sincere, correct, and incorrect memories may be critical to reaching valid judicial decisions, research has demonstrated that people have great difficulty in judging the accuracy of others' memories. Despite its importance to the judicial process, relatively little research has examined the extent in which erroneous eyewitness memories may differ from those that are accurate. The present study attempts to provide insight into potential differences between honestly reported, correct and incorrect verbal eyewitness testimonies. We do this by replicating and extending the research of Lindum et al., from 2018, in which memory accuracy was found to be related to indicators of retrieval effort in witnesses' responses. Now, this is a substantially lengthy article. So it goes on to point out all the different practices that they used and employed to study and get the information that they needed. And the conclusion says that taken together, this study lends new support to the notion that retrieval effort and eyewitness responses is central for discriminating accurate from inaccurate recall of event details. Moreover, our findings suggest that a coarser but more inclusive measure of delays before and during a response explains more variance in accuracy than response latency. We show that effort cues partly mediate the relationship between accuracy and confidence, supporting the hypothesis that aspects of confidence are based on implicit inferential processes. These findings suggest promising new ways of improving judgments in eyewitness evidence. And this goes and supports exactly what the Restack article is about in The Guardian. So in summary, we aren't as good at memory as we think we are. We need cues, and if we reconstruct memories based on images and cue words, we can do a whole lot better than just believing in our own falsely confident memories, because most of us do not have photographic memory or eidetic memory or total recall, as we like to believe. Most of us don't have that good a memory at all. That doesn't mean you're suffering from dementia. That doesn't mean you have Alzheimer's. You can be absent-minded or just forgetful or just have a lapse, or you just weren't concentrating on that at that time. So let's give each other a break and think about our own health, our own mental health, and what we can do to slow down the onset of dementia and Alzheimer's in our own lives. Thanks for listening. See you next time. And as the kiddies say, peace out.